Once upon a time, in a quiet valley of West Virginia, two men named Jack Goldberg and Adam Silverton each bought a piece of land. Though they had never met before, their properties shared a boundary, and at the very center stood an old but sturdy cabin. Jack and Adam both had the same dream, to settle down, to start a family, and work the land. They each married, built their homes, and watched their children grow. But as their families expanded, so did their need for space. Their cabin, sitting squarely on the border, became a point of contention. Each man believed the cabin should belong to him. Jack argued it was closer to his best grazing fields. Adam insisted it was better suited for his growing storage needs. At first, they tried to be civil, but resentment grew. A cold rivalry set in. Their sons, once playmates, began to mimic their father's bitterness. They quarreled over who had the right to use the cabin, until one day, their fighting turned violent. Adam's son, Jackson, was badly injured. From that moment on, the two families became bitter enemies. The feud escalated over the years. Harsh words became threats. Threats became brawls, and brawls turned into bloodshed. More family members were drawn into the conflict. The cabin, once a simple wooden structure, became a symbol of their hatred for one another. On Jackson's 19th birthday, terrible tragedy struck. A fight turned deadly, and Adam's eldest son was killed. Grief and vengeance consumed both families. Their dispute over the cabin transformed into an all-out war. They gathered their allies, wielded knives and guns, and battled without end. The valley became a battleground soaked in sorrow, all because of a claim to a cabin neither man had built. Then, one fateful winter night, a blizzard swept through the valley. Both families clashed in the freezing snow. The battle was brutal. By dawn, nearly everyone lay dead or too wounded to fight. The only two left standing were Jack and Adam. Then the fire started. First, Adam's house caught flame. The wind carried the embers to Jack's barn, then his home. The inferno spread without mercy, consuming everything in its path. As the two men stood watching their life's work turn to ash, the cruel truth settled in. Their land was ruined, their families were nearly gone, and the cabin, their precious cabin, was nothing more than cinders in the snow. With nowhere to go and the storm still raging, Jack and Adam had only each other. Huddling together for warmth, they stripped off their pride, their grudges, and their illusions. Side by side, they held on through the long frozen night. In the silence, they finally understood. The cabin had never mattered. Their hatred had cost them everything. The moral of the story: we humans often lose sight of what is truly important. We chased after possessions, power, and pride, forgetting that in the end, none of it will matter. What will matter is our choices, our ability to love, to forgive, and to see beyond material illusions. Do the math. Spirituality does matter. 10 minus 8 leaves 2. Your choices are of utmost importance. Hello, friends. My name is Chris Jansen. Check out my work at endevil.life. And welcome to the Funnel 4 Conference, Humanity Rising. This is my special presentation titled Spiritual Mathematics. Today, I hope you can view this presentation as the juror and the judge. You decide which things make sense to you. It's going to be up to you to discern and decide how to put these pieces together of this puzzle that I'm going to present for you today. I will present exhibits. I've tried to create a path of reason, a path of understanding for you to follow, but it's up to you to decide how to put these pieces together in the following days, weeks, and moments after you watch this presentation. I challenge you to try to be objective. That is one of the most important and crucial aspects of this presentation, is objectivity. And what this requires is building a bridge between what we've known previously or what we've understood previously and working towards new realizations or new horizons. There's always an aspect of the unknown. And that is crossing over the current moment, which is the current of water flowing beneath this bridge. The thoughts, ideas, and information that is currently moving and is never staying exactly the same if we are indeed travelers on this road of knowledge. You be the judge, you be the jury of what's right and wrong. That is the end message of all this. Working towards freedom, understanding natural law is recognizing that we are all conscious beings connected to source. We come from the source, and in that is our ability to find knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. The three-step process called the Trivium, which we laid out well in Funnel 3. And if you haven't checked that out, please go back to Freedom Under Natural Law 3 and freedomundernaturallaw.com. And we will proceed with a Trivium-style thought process. This presentation I especially made for those of you who tend to be a little more analytical left-brain thinkers, and I'm trying to set one stone in front of the other so we can build this stone bridge and then build a beautiful tapestry of knowledge on top of that. Let's start with some definitions. What am I talking about when I use the word spiritual? Any word we look up in the dictionary, we'll find three or four iterations of explanations, which are all slightly different. Here is a spattering of comparisons of different dictionaries and how they define the word spiritual. The Oxford, Merriam, Cambridge all have a little bit of different nuances, but I just kind of want to point out that the Cambridge is the most different here on this list. The Cambridge says relating to deep feelings and beliefs, especially religious beliefs. This is the most foreign. This is the most, the definition which I least would like to highlight in this presentation. We're talking to things that are related to the human spirit as opposed to material or physical things. Oxford, I like much better. Incorporeal, affecting the spirit. Relating to the spirit or soul rather than the body or physical matters. This is the basic understanding of what the word spiritual means. It does not necessarily have to have a religious connotation. So if that's the way you think of the word, please, for the sake of this presentation, put that aside. Mathematics is the study of structure, quantity, and space and change within those. The abstract science of number, quantity, and space, recognize abstract concepts comes up a lot in this definition. When we think of mathematics as being a very objective, solid thing, we find that it actually is about shapes and space. And we have a way to reason and a special system of symbols we use to organize this type of reason. I like the systematic treatment of magnitude. Everything depends on context in mathematics, between figures and forms, relationships between quantities expressed symbolically. So we're not quite so boring here. Mathematics is a study of numbers, quantities, and measurements and shapes, relationships between them. So spiritual mathematics, what am I talking about? I'm creating my own compound word, just like the word magicians do in our society from their tower. Our physical body is indeed a spiritual connection because it comes from source and it is our most, should be our most treasured and prized gift. But the universe's most treasured and prized gift is the gift of life. The etymological meaning was also breathing. To breathe, you will find if you spend some time looking into the word spirit is a common etymological origin of that word. But what I'm talking about, to sort of sum it all up, the non-physical, right? The non-material connection with source. That is our divine connection. That's the way I like to explain what I'm really talking about when I'm using the word spiritual and when I'm calling it spiritual mathematics. And mathematics being a scientific process of discovery involving principles that exist inherently in reality. So to learn, we discover and learn things that are there. We don't necessarily need to make them up, but we do come up with tools and we do make up tools to dissect reality. So mathematics is an objective measurements. It's an analytical tool to dissect reality. I'm trying to help humans that are attempting to avoid using their native default functions. I see this happening. I call it instinctual reluctance. We need to get back to our source, back to what's natural, back to what's inside of us. There's been a lot of failed experiments on this earth of human conditioning and trying to turn man and women into machines and to make them follow orders. All these types of nature avoidance theory experiments have failed miserably and led to trauma. This is where we're going right now in these pots, like these pods, like we saw in the Matrix. It's humans attempting to replace natural functions with created technology. If we keep heading down that road, we end up exactly in those pods of the Matrix, like we're going to talk a little bit more about. I'd like to pause for a moment and send you to, after this presentation, take a note. When you get an opportunity, I'd like you to check out The Nature of Symbols and The Symbols of Nature, one of my favorite presentations I've created. It's on YouTube, and it really bridges a gap of why symbols are so important and why it's so important to look at things metaphorically. There's a lot of metaphor in this symbol I've created for this presentation with the compass and the square and the king and in concentric circles and the different cardinal directions representing principles. But we'll get more into that. I'm asking you to recognize that we are all living in Plato's cave to some extent. The material reality is actually shadows that are cast on the wall of reality. The non-material reality is the source. That's where things come from, is the non-material reality. And it happens only in that order. It's very important to understand that. Deceivers don't want you to recognize that. They're the ones that are holding up odd shapes and signs and pictures and words to confuse you and mesmerize you to keep you from recognizing that you're in a cycle of slavery. And the world is, for the most part, either sitting in that cave as a slave or being part of the deceiving process. And that cyclical process is reality right now. It doesn't have to be a reality we have for our future. And that's what we're working towards, ending evil. The reality is that reality is, by my definition, the world or the state of things as they actually exist, as opposed to an idealistic or notional idea of them. We're trying to bring that part of ourselves awake that wants to step out of this cave, that wants to see the reality for what it really is. Reality is indeed spirituality. Reality is indeed the emotions and the conscience that were given to us by the universe to not be trapped, to work towards freedom, to find freedom. And those of us that go through the agony of waking from the cave and pushing ourselves out of that sphincter of a problem that we're in here, a rock in a hard place, and you know, having to rub our eyes the first time we've ever seen light and recognize that freedom would require that people did not rule over us, and would require that people could not tax us without us having a good reason for it, or us choosing that we are willing to give someone money, right? Or time, or energy, or our life, or our children's life. We need to learn as humanity that the future we're heading towards is the Neo from the Matrix. It is the machines owning us completely, and us being batteries that run an endless clock that has no care or love. And this is not what we want, nor is it what nature will tolerate in the long term. Neo means new or young or recent when you look at the etymology, the origin of this word. From Greek, neos, youthful, fresh, strange. We need a new paradigm. Awaken, friends. There is a new way of thinking that we need to work towards. The old routines are leading us in a dangerous path, and the equation is not working out. There is a mathematical reality to the path we're on, and it's not equaling the future that we want to see. So that's going to require more work on us, and I believe that can be done on a psychological, mental, and spiritual realm. We just need to solidify our ways of looking at these things, apply trivium, and learn to communicate better with one another to build trust. A conspiracy is often seen as a harmful or evil plan formulated in secret by two or more persons. It's often not seen that way, but that is what the actual word means. Something like 9/11, where we know that there was an evil plot, and we just don't know exactly how and when, but there's for sure no doubt that there were more than one person formulating this plan in a harmful way. A mystery is something that just that remains unknown or unexplained, not necessarily a conspiracy. And that's like the pyramids. We don't necessarily know that that was a conspiratorial element. It may have been beneficial. It might have been constructive. We learn a lot from the mathematics, speaking of mathematics, in that ancient structure. And that mystery is not a conspiracy, as it is a mystery. And then a word that sounds like mystery is mastery. And I want to encourage you to find your passion. If you want to actually learn something, whether it's from my presentation or another one in this conference, you have to truly desire and will to want to learn. And I want to share with you some wisdom from my self-defense teacher, Larry Morris, who is pictured here holding his bow staff. And he taught me some really important skill, and I hope you can apply it to your learning process as we go through this presentation and others. Number one, if you want to work towards mastery, you need to choose something you are passionate about, something you care deeply about, and you must understand why it's important to you or the world. Number two, you have to then find someone who has mastered some aspect of the skill that you are seeking, someone that you can learn from, someone that will teach you to reach your goal of mastery. For me, in the self-defense field, it was Larry Morris. In the spirituality field, I learned a lot from Mark Passio and others, but these were some of the teachers that really helped me. And then I spent time learning from the master. Step three, you emulate, duplicate, and train. First, you have to copy to learn someone, right? You copy what they're doing, notice how they're doing it, and you train over and over and over until you get good at it. Practice in your mind, body, and spirit, and you'll learn even faster. Number four is hone it till you own it, right? Study and repeat what you have learned until you know it like the back of your hand. Larry calls this the honing stage. And when you've got that honed like the back of your hand, your skill you've been working towards so hard, you practice it and make it your own. You make it art. That's what art is. When you learn to make it work for your own mind, body, and spirit, and you own that responsibility like you care about it, like it's the most valuable thing you ever earned because you did earn it the hard way. And that is the essence of solving the world's problems and your own problems in your personal life. The goal of this presentation is to help develop symbolic tools as practical metaphors to understand reality, to simplify complexity, to gain clarity, and to take focused action. So I'm sharing with you today some tools. We talked about developing symbolic tools. I think these tools can be practical metaphors. I'm picking you some tools out of my very own toolbox. These symbolic tools, I hope you can use going forward, not only in my presentation, but how you think about things in the future. But I know they hold true because I hold them in the physical reality, just as I will hold them for you now in the mental space. The square, I would say, is one of the most important tools I carry when I'm at work in construction. It's right on my hip at all times. Like I reach for it like you would a gun in war. It helps you clarify two points. And those same two points can be squared in anywhere in the world by someone who speaks any language, and we will get the same straight line. It is objective. The square is the objectivity tool. The square signifies objectivity and symmetry, creating structure and balance. It brings clarity to reasoning, enabling precision in distinguishing truth from falsehood. Two points make a line. It represents the foundational geometry that differentiates one point, a singularity, from two, duality. I take out my tape measure, I measure the point, I put the square on there, and it makes a line I can cut, and then it becomes something real in the world. It differentiates the one from the two. It anchors reasoning with accuracy linked to geometric clarity and the creation of lines, that is, the relationship between points, which is also communication at its core. Objectivity is required for any type of true communication. However, communication can be cut apart. And the tool we use for this is the knife. I think almost all of you out there are fellow contrarians. We're the type of people that like to ask, but why? How come? How long? Don't take something as a whole. We don't just swallow a pill when someone says something. We ask why. The knife represents questioning and cutting things apart to understand their components. Slicing and dicing, it fragments and partitions ideas. It helps us to see the pieces of a larger puzzle. The knife is a neutral tool. It can prepare a loving meal or can stab somebody and cause great harm. Depends on how it's used, how it's wielded. In discussions, it's the contrarian force that helps us dissect arguments. This is used early on in the trivium process, right? After we have the information, we start slicing it and dicing it. It's essential for breaking concepts into manageable parts. But you take it too far, you cut something into oblivion, and it loses all meaning. So it's a tool that can be overdone very easily. The level is one of my favorite tools. It's the divine bubble of justice, the balance in this world. You can find it. It's discoverable, inherent, just like moral principles. We create this tool with a bubble in it so we can find that little bubble. And what's interesting, too, is if you shake your level, you can even get that bubble to split. But if you just let it calm for a minute, it turns back into one bubble, not even a minute, seconds, you know. Equilibrium and the ability to find harmony in oneself and in your community. This tool is necessary as you're drawing in information. It helps you to assess whether something is balanced, fair, or aligned with higher principles. It ensures that thoughts and actions are centered. Centered, right? That's what we call it. Find your center. How are you going to build if your level, if your foundation is not level? Everything's going to be crooked. If you try to do framing on a foundation that's not level, every single cut is different. If it's level, they're all the same. At least all certain pieces, right, of the wall. You use this to assess the fairness or alignment of an idea with moral or spiritual truths. It encourages the seeker to maintain harmony and integrity in their actions. If we were to all use these types of tools in conversations with others in person and online, we would have more effective communication. I want to challenge people in this presentation. I know that we are subjective beings. We'll talk about some of the philosophers who discuss this. I know that we are experiencing this from a subjective lens. However, we do have the ability to cognize, to think, to imagine, and we can see things outside of our own personal, just like watching a movie. We can recognize from using just a tiny bit of imagination or belief that takes just a little trust to use our logical thought and to correlate the most factual and corroborated evidence that's available. And that is the art of advanced objectivity. A small element of imagination with an emphasis on logical thought. We can correlate the most factual and corroborated evidence available. We can use this tool in everything we do and combine it with the adjustable wrench. Things don't always fit perfect. Sometimes things aren't quite right. There's a way we've been thinking about it. We know we're close. We're onto something, but we're not quite there. The wrench represents adaptability and precision. The ability to tighten or loosen as needed. It's used to make adjustments, ensuring all parts of a system work together and in context. That's so important, the context, right? This tool, as you see the way it's sitting, the jaws are turned in this direction. It gets leverage by going, the handles would go not that direction, but that direction. You would pull the handles that way to get the most leverage because that's the fulcrum point of how the pliers work. I'm having a little trouble displaying it with my hands, but the two handles represent two pillars. How would you pull leverage with one handle, right? We have to use both sides of our brain, but there is a right way and a wrong way to turn the nut if you're trying to tighten it versus loosen it. And so we have to learn to put things into context and be intentional. The pliers have a strong side and a weak side, see the shorter jaw and the longer jaw. That is intentional. It highlights the importance of balance and correction. So adjusting your perspective, see, that way, got it. Adjusting your perspective or modifying rigid beliefs to improve clarity and flow. Essential in fine-tuning logic or systems to enhance functionality. So you got to get the job done. You actually want to have a conversation. You actually want to create understanding with people. We have to adjust how we speak. We might have to adjust which words we use. We might have to adjust our own perspective and context out or in a little bit in order to find a happy medium in order to make our point. If we want to make a point, we kind of got to be on the same page with someone. So that bubble and adjustment and square, all that has to be out of the way. I purposely didn't bring the hammer tool in too soon. If you start trying to hammer your point home too soon, you make a mess of things. And that's true on the job site as well. Go too crazy with the hammer without getting all the pieces in place. You make a bloody mess of your hands and the project. This is the rhetoric tool. It represents focused force, the power to drive a point home with impact. It applies energy and finality to ideas, ensuring they land with conviction. It's comparable to nailing a concept perfectly. When someone nails it, they've effectively made their point. And so you don't want to, none of us want to start speaking too strongly until we know what we're talking about. That's important to save the rhetoric tool for when we have thought things out and then we can say them in an effective manner. This is for making powerful statements or applying the final touch to an argument. In teaching, the hammer delivers lessons that resonate deeply, which again, all about timing. So let's talk about geometry and math. Equations are ways of figuring things out. When we do mathematics, we balance an equation, right? And the same is true of going through a mental thought process or working through a spiritual conundrum or moral problem or ethical problem. We can be reasonable, just like this aspect of geometry that I always appreciated. This is my own personal process here of charting out some of my thoughts and working towards this essay and working towards this presentation. Is I was thinking to myself, I know that the given is, in my mind, objective truth exists. I'm trying to prove to the listener that objective morality exists. And so the statements I'm going through in my mind are objective truth exists, right? We can agree that there's a rock. We can agree that there's a Mount Everest. We can agree it hurts when rocks hit you in the head or when you fall off Mount Everest. We can agree and communicate is the reason I can make that statement. Morality is defined by harmful behavior to conscious beings. There's the statement. The reason I think that's true is because it can be defined. It can be defined fairly simply. Forms of stealing, such as assault, rape, murder, theft, trespassing, and coercion. In my mind, I don't see a time those things are not true as being harmful. Unless self-defense, in which case I wouldn't define them as harmful behavior. I would, call them self-defense. And it wouldn't be a rape, murder, or theft, that's for sure, in self-defense. However, I could see someone calling something assault, trespassing, or coercion self-defense if they did not recognize that someone needed to defend themselves, and which is part of the major crux of the problem in this world right now. Suffering and slavery are defined by objective morality, and that's why people are confused about that, because deep down, slavery is an immoral behavior. I'm sure of it. I think most people are sure of it deep down, if they're honest, and the results of that immoral behavior can be observed. We can see all over the world that humans are continuing to experience mass suffering and slavery. I'm not saying that this slide should prove it to you. I'm saying that you can create your own slide like this using thought process, using reason, and we can come to conclusions that we can agree on that make sense. One way to do that is using Venn diagrams. The red circle in this picture represents your computer. The black circle represents this image. You and I are the green X. Here we are on the same page right now. A Venn diagram is a widely used diagram that shows logical relationships. Remember mathematical relationships? Popularized by John Venn in the 1800s. It used to teach elementary set theory.
And but I just noticed it works great for thinking in philosophy terms as well. Here's one example. I was playing with the idea of you and the universe. That could be me and the me-verse too. And the blue circle is kind of representing everything that exists, which is true. There is everything that exists, right? And it's true that you and I exist within that everything. However, what we think exists, there can also be things outside of that realm. And that's called imagination. I can imagine a pink dragon with purple polka dots on its toenails, and that never existed in reality before, and probably no one ever said it quite like that. I just created something that's outside of what exists. And that's a unique aspect of being a conscious, intelligent being. It's the ability to imagine things that are not real or do not exist, incorporeal, like we talked about. And that's why there's so much confusion about the spiritual world. But I think it's important to point out that the great all, everything, the source, we could not even have imagination if it were not for that. So this whole page fits, and this whole presentation and the realm of the imagination all fit within the bigger great all. So I should have made a bigger circle around everything for that. But that's an inherent truth that we can discover, right? Spiritual mathematics is simple. It's something anyone and everyone can come to understand. I would recommend work your way through philosophers over time to see the progression of thought, compare their different ideas, and work these processes in your mind. They're not all the same. Immanuel Kant, I found very difficult to read. He uses a lot of words that are foreign to me, and he puts a lot of big words together in sentences, and he goes back and forth and around and back and forth, and very amazingly intelligent. But even people at the time called him confusing to read. But his basic thoughts on ethics, morality is grounded in rationality and the categorical imperative. He did recognize universal moral laws that can be followed regardless of consequences, that must be followed, universal moral laws. Act only according to that maxim whereby you can, at the same time, will that it should become a universal law. So let's just kind of get a feeling for some different philosophers. David Hume. He was a proponent of empirical skepticism. He believed that morality was rooted in human emotions rather than reason. Moral judgments are based on sentiments shared among people. Morality is not a matter of reason, but of sentiment. I don't tend to agree with Hume's point of view, but it's important to take in all the different thinkers and compare them. Let's look at Friedrich Nietzsche. He's critiquing traditional morality. He says morality as a social construct. He recognizes that there's this master morality versus slave morality thing going on. Moral values are subjective and vary by culture. There are no moral phenomenon, but only a moral interpretation of phenomena. So these different thinkers have put things together in different ways. But it's important to take time and read somebody's work before we draw quick conclusions. These are sort of just like generalized statements about these characters that do not encompass their whole description. But I just wanted to point out that there has been a variety of thoughts on these topics. And we can see where some people have landed. They've stayed more with the Nietzschean Hume style of thinking, that this is all based on feelings. And Manly P. Hall says, emphasis on universal truths, moral principles from various spiritual traditions. True morality arises from a synthesis of wisdom across cultures and higher spiritual understanding. The greatest knowledge is to know that you do not know. So there's another take on it. Let's look at Rudolf Steiner's. He believes that moral principles evolve with spiritual development. Morality is holistic. We're working our way towards a better morality. True moral understanding comes from an inner development and spiritual awareness. The moral imperative is not an abstract principle. It is the living reality of the soul. I really like how he put that. That hits hard with me. I see a progression here of thinkers. I see thinkers that have gone through some pretty tough times in history and seen lived through socialism and difficult things and trying to figure out what's going on. And we're getting a better perspective as we move through different philosophers here. I think, this is the way I see it, Mark Passio is a progression. He sees natural law as a universal moral code. He emphasizes personal responsibility. He emphasizes causality, the consequences of our actions. Objective morality is inherent. Natural law principle governs all human interaction. He says to be a spiritual moral being means to not believe in anything. It means to know the truth about morality. And that's where, you know, that will really hit home with me. And that's why I'm sharing with you spiritual mathematics. I don't think it's anyone's guess. I think it's discernible, just like scientific process of mathematics. We can figure things out using the correct tools of thought. But we're going to have to stop for a minute in the world of quantum physics, because this is where many people get lost, confused, and circled back like Immanuel Kant's reasoning. The study of matter and energy at the most fundamental level, we got to know about Max Planck. Max concluded that energy comes in tiny chunks called quanta. This idea started the field of quantum mechanics. Max Planck is a big deal in that field. He was dedicated to discovering the absolute laws of nature through reasoning. Wow, that sounds spiritual. He had a strong belief in the first and second laws of thermodynamics as universal principles. Those are things which can be tested, corroborated, and confirmed. In the book, The End of All Evil by Jeremy Locke, he talks about thermodynamics as universal principles. So Max Planck initiated the quantum revolution, fundamentally altering the understanding of atomic and subatomic behavior. In many ways, quantum physics has bridged somewhat of the gap between religion, spirituality, and matter and reality and mathematics, because it shows that even in the study of matter, G, and energy, there is contradiction, there is confusion, there are things that are mysterious that are still mysteries, right? The double slit experiment is one of the big ones. It shows that particles, e.g. electrons and photons, can behave like both waves and particles. This was, you know, the discoveries by Einstein that then later were argued, and then we'll get more into Einstein in just a minute. Without observation, particles passing through two slits create an interference pattern on a screen, acting like waves. When observed, the particles behave like discrete particles, and their interference pattern disappears. At first, this can be very confusing and hard to grapple with, but we're going to go over it one more time. But basically, the idea is of the double slit experiment is that it implies that the observation influences the behavior of quantum systems. Whether it's photons, electrons, or these particles, they act differently depending on whether they're being watched and observed. The probabilistic nature of reality has challenged classical determinism. For many years, a lot of people thought everything was fate and your life's like a play that God already wrote and we're just acting it out. This is one of those things that really kicked that bucket over, you know? This implies that the observation influences the behavior of quantum systems, highlighting the probabilistic nature of reality. And so here's some of the images. It's a little hard to tell the difference, but you get a pattern. They put a screen that has, it can record the action that hit it, like light hitting it, like a photograph, right? Without observation, the particles that are passing through the two slits create an interference pattern on a screen, acting like waves. But when observed, the particles behave like discrete particles and the interference pattern disappears. So two different scientists arguing two different points. Turns out they're both true. This is the Schrodinger's cat convention where they talk about this. How can two things be true and not true at the same time? How do photons or particles know where they're going before they're going there? Depending on how would they know if they were being observed, right? The double slit experiment demonstrates that particles like electrons or photons can exhibit both wave-like and particle-like behavior when these particles are passed through two slits. And I just explained the whole thing again there. You know, when they pass through without observation, one thing happens. When they pass through with observation, the other result happens. That's the gist of it. And that has caused a lot of disagreement and theorizing and back and forth in scientists and philosophy, and even the mindset of modern individuals who have trouble understanding the concept of advanced objectivity, which is what we're covering in this presentation. Niels Bohr himself said, everything we call real is made of things that cannot be regarded as real. He described atoms as tiny solar systems, but later realized electrons could jump and exist in cloud-like orbitals. And we had Albert Einstein. He said, God does not play dice with the universe. He explained light as tiny bouncing balls. He was the proponent of the photon theory, particles called photons. He won a Nobel Prize for the photoelectric effect. Smart guy, but I tend to lean towards the guy who created all the technology we use today, from AC electricity to the telegraph. Almost every electrical thing we're using today is a function of somebody who figured out an actual equation and applied it to reality, and that's Nikola Tesla. Real big on the numbers 6 and 9. And 3, Tesla viewed the universe as a deeply interconnected system. He saw many of his inventions, he said, in dreams. He was a spiritual person. He was heard to saying, every living being is an engine geared to the wheelwork of the universe. If you want to find the secrets of the universe, think in terms of energy, frequency, and vibration. Tesla was openly critical of Einstein's theories of relativity, describing them as a magnificent mathematical garb. And here's the guy who actually invented things that we actually use on a day-to-day basis. In reality, of all the forces of friction, the one that most retards human movement is ignorance, right? We don't want to look a little deeper. We don't want to connect the spiritual, mental, and the physical all together because that's too scary, right? That might be actual reality. He emphasized that the universe operates on immutable natural laws. Where have we heard that before? Suggesting his belief in an objective structure to reality. Governed by these principles, he described the role of energy as the true driver of progress. So where do we put our energy and our time actually is what we create in the world. Inherent and discoverable order to existence. I just recognize a lot of spiritual facts in these mathematical concepts that create real-world technologies. He said, if you want to find the secrets of the universe, think in terms of energy, frequency, and vibration. Sounds very much like what you read in the Hermetic principles, if you read the Kybalion, for instance. He said about Einstein, Einstein's relativity work is a magnificent mathematical garb, which fascinates, dazzles, and makes people blind to the underlying errors. The theory is like a beggar clothed in purple, whom ignorant people take for a king. Its exponents are brilliant men, but they are metaphysicists rather than scientists. So I understand why people get frustrated with philosophy, because some philosophers go around and around and confuse the subject more than they make the point. And then you got guys like Tesla that get to the point and get stuff done. Also need to bring up Werner Heisenberg, talk about bridging the gap between the physical and the non-physical. He discovered the uncertainty principle. Not only is the universe stranger than we think, he said, it is stranger than we can think. We can't even think that strange. Natural science does not simply describe and explain nature. It is part of the interplay between nature and ourselves. It is impossible to simultaneously know both the exact position and the exact momentum of a particle. The more precisely one property is measured, the less precisely the other can be determined. This principle highlights a fundamental limit in the precision of measurements at the quantum level. So his uncertainty principle basically says, you might be able to find exactly where a particle's at, but you're never going to know where it's going. If you can figure out where it's going, you can, but then you know you will never be able to figure out where it was at. So it's almost like they know but don't know where they're going and where they've been. And we can figure out where they've been or where they're going, but not both at the same time. So it's a very interesting principle about reality, and it has to do with, I believe, the moral aspect, the glue that holds everything together. Reality is about freedom. Reality is about love. Reality is about truth. And we're here to discover these things. One of the discoverers that blows my mind and still affects my working life on a day-to-day basis is Pythagoras. A squared plus B squared equals C squared. Nate Kapp refers this as the Egyptian string trick. To me, it's just finding square. I have to find a right angle anytime I'm going to build something. If I'm going to make a deck, for instance, I have to find a square corner and build from there. Otherwise, all my cuts are going to be crooked. But if I find a square corner, I can make things very symmetrical and the whole process goes faster. So I understand this mathematical concept. Pythagoras was a philosopher. He was a mathematician, yes, but he was also a mystic and known to be a religious leader. A Pythagorean school was a mystery school, a secretive, religious, and philosophical society. Because all through history, authoritarians don't want people to understand this type of knowledge, because why would we need people to rule over us if we could build our own structures and we could understand the universe and understand the dynamics of how to treat one another in a proper way? I want to refer here to Leslie Power's presentation on music. Music is very right-brained, intuitive, deals with our emotions, yet it is based on mathematics, and mathematics can be discovered. They are inherently part of music. Pythagoras discovered mathematical ratios and musical harmony, such as an octave or a 2-to-1 ratio or the fifths. The circle of fifths is how we find all the different keys in music. Great inspiration, Pythagoras, and bridges the gap again between reality and spirituality. Another is sacred geometry. Inside of sacred geometry, I just see so many correspondences to everything else we've talked about. The Vesica Pisces, I think of mitosis of cells. I think of what we talked about, the Venn diagrams. The space between represents the egg of birth, right? The two coming together, creating the one, the seed of life, the birth emerging, turning into the flower life, getting more complex, and then growing into the Metatron's cube, which within Metatron's cube, all the Platonic solids nestle perfectly, one within another. And the Platonic solids are just extremely exciting. We're going to pop through them in just a minute. But we got to stop in at the Mandelbrot set. If you haven't yet, look up Mandelbrot on YouTube and watch how the Mandelbrot set works. It's mesmerizing. Its importance lies in its demonstration of how simple mathematical rules create infinite complexity. Right? Infinite complexity. They're very right brain concepts. The Mandelbrot set models self-similarity and recursion, revealing patterns of both chaos and order. When you watch one of these videos and see the Mandelbrot set moving, it doesn't seem like anything matches. Seems like a bunch of randomness, but then you start seeing the order keeps showing up, the same shapes, the same similarities. The more you zoom in, the more you see. The more you zoom in, the more you see. It symbolizes infinite possibilities, mathematical beauty, and the boundary between stability and chaos. This is the reality we live in. It's based on choices. We make moral choices and we get different outcomes. This pattern exists inherently in reality and creation, both the subatomic level and the day-to-day level. We can see these same correspondences. Let's go through the Platonic solids real quickly. Notice that they also have a correspondence to non-physical forms. The sphere, the earth, the fire is the air, ether, spirit, and water. These are all concepts that can be thought of symbolically, but they also do exist in nature. The Platonic solids can be found all through nature. They exist on their own. We don't have to cut these shapes out. We find them. I'm just going to go through them quickly. The tetrahedron, the hexahedron or the cube, the octahedron, the dodecahedron, and the icosahedron. I'm not sure if I pronounced that correctly. I find them particularly fascinating because, as I said, another aspect of reality that's discoverable and real and represents metaphorical truths, metaphorical spiritual truths. All things fit within each other, and within all things, within every cell, exists every other thing. And this is the correspondence of the universe. And the mentalism, it shows the complexity and how thought it out it really is. Another concept that came into my mind that's sort of a big exhibit in terms of bridging the gap between this mathematical reality physical world reality that's so strange and has so many mysteries about it is the game of chess, a game that's been invented, created, and partially discovered. It requires tactics, which are short-term calculations, very analytical thinking, strategy, long-term planning. And yet, it also involves an intuitive, right-brained understanding of the player you're against. The key principles involve controlling the center, finding the center, right? Like the bubble on the level. Developing the pieces efficiently, right? Adjustable wrench. And protecting the king. That might be the hammer, and that might be the square. Players must anticipate opponents' moves and adapt to their strategy. This is so important to recognize the context of the world we're in. The king and pawn relationship tells us so much about the world we're in and the context of why this presentation is about objective morality. What we need to learn is the balance of power in this world and in our own self is what's going to make all the difference. Think about the king in the game of chess. The king needs support. He can only move one square at a time. Everyone must sacrifice to save him. In a community, the king could represent freedom. Freedom for all, right? Freedom needs our support. Freedom is one step at a time, how it's gained and kept. And everyone must be willing to make a sacrifice in order to maintain freedom for all. Yet we do not want to be ruled. The king, we don't want to represent an external force. We want the king to represent our internal self force, right? Our ego. That is a balanced type of authority, is called responsibility. That's when we have self-discipline within ourselves to understand when things are right or understand when things are out of balance. If we put that job to someone else and let someone else be the king, then we become their pawn. And we only sacrifice for their rules. So what will you choose in this life going forward? Will you choose to be someone else's pawn in your enemy's game, owned by the rulers and psychopaths of this world? That's the context of the world we're in. So if you want to find true authority, you need to find your own inner authority to understand the mathematical, objective, advanced objectivity to be able to discern the difference between right and wrong, and not put yourself and the future of other people in the crosshairs of slavery. So we started out with the story of the Silvertons and the Goldmans, the all too familiar tale of an old family feud that refused to die because people couldn't let go of their hatred. It's really a simple matter of mathematical realization. A man and a woman come together, have children, growing into a larger family. Kind of like an equation. Things are adding up. Perhaps a grandmother comes to say, and the family extends even more. But what happens when the leadership in that family, its mother and father, make terrible moral decisions? If they covet their neighbor's home or harbor hatred instead of seeking reconciliation, they pass down that resentment. What began as self-defense becomes retribution. The wounds are deepened instead of healing. Holding on to anger, hatred, and malice leads to subtraction, not addition. The family fractures, the community weakens, and the people become less whole. Yet, if we choose conscious moral behavior, that means truly understanding the difference between right and wrong. Just like the right angle in mathematical equation or the right angle that I find with my square on the job site, it's the same right here as it is anywhere in the world for any other beings that are conscious and aware. Right is not stealing. Right is doing things that you would want done to you. Not that complicated. We can discern this rightness with a little bit of objectivity, as we talked about, advanced objectivity, and being able to communicate and corroborate with other beings. It's not that conflicts will never arise, but the mathematical outcome would be far less destructive. Instead of a tragic ending where two cold, shivering men stand alone with no families and no homes, the community could flourish, and there could be addition and growth. This pattern extends to the individual and to society as a whole. One person can do so much damage, whether through murder, theft, coercion, or deceit. But when a group of people form an organization, the potential for harm grows exponentially. When an organization calls itself a corporation or a government, the scale of destruction can reach historic levels. Wars, genocides, and systematic oppression. It's the difference between math, addition, and multiplication, the amount of evil we bring into the world. What is the mathematical difference between one individual's immoral decision and a government controlling mass atrocities or committing genocide of a whole race? Unlike human beings, neither a government nor a corporation has a soul. They have no divine connection except that what they steal or borrow from the individuals who lend their belief and offer their participation to these artificial constructs. Anything that lacks a foundation in moral principles and with respect to objective reality is no more than a false religion. We can agree on this. We can see how things work out in the world. It's like an equation. Despite this, many still cling to the belief that objectivity does not exist. But if that were true, why does the word objective exist at all? Well, no single individual may ever be 100% objective. We have tools to help us. Just as a square or a level ensures precision in construction, we can check our own consciousness and collaborate with others and compare to get as close to the truth as we possibly can. Advanced objectivity. Reality is not as complicated as some would have us believe. The mathematics of the universe is discoverable, even though within each discovery, new mysteries arise. This is the beauty of life and the great mystery of the great all. Consider the double slit experiment, or quantum mechanics, where photons behave both as particles and waves, depending on observation. How do particles know where they're going? This paradox mirrors the mystery of the divine connection, the great all. There will always be an element of faith, a lingering uncertainty, just like the uncertainty principle. Yet this is precisely why we need each other. Relationships are our mirror to reality, to recognize how we're doing, how we reflect upon others. How did our actions work out, and what are we receiving for them? This is why particles and photons don't go there until we make the decisions of our moral decisions in this world. Then reality reacts based on natural law principles. That's what reality is made of. That's what's going on. So do the math. We need to work together to find the common denominator, which is morality and spirituality. If we fail to recognize objective morality, we risk living in a future like the Matrix, reduced to mere energy sources, slaves for a technological machine. Or we end up like the Silvertons and the Goldmans, annihilating each other over unresolved conflicts, lost in the material world, and failing to see the spiritual truth that underlies it. Plato's cave warns us of this blindness. If we want to help others break free from the chains, if we want to provide a future for people that come after us, we are the answers. We must inspire them to seek the light, no matter how painful it might be at first. Truth is about reality. Reality is about divine natural law order. Just as Platonic solids, geometric principles, and numbers have objective meaning, so too does morality. Communication itself is a language of symbols. It's our tool for recognizing and corroborating reality so we can strive towards truth. I call on you to make the choice to cross the bridge of mental and spiritual realization. Except that we can find a common denominator and a common sense solution to moral and spiritual issues. As difficult as it may be, it's necessary. No one but you can determine your personal purpose. I can offer you the tools, I can draw maps, and I can point towards the bridge, but only you can walk across it. Only you can decide how to apply your purpose to solving the greatest problem of our time, human slavery. There's no issue more important than human freedom. Slavery is evil, and the destruction of freedom is the destruction of humanity itself. Let us work together towards true freedom through understanding and living in alignment with natural law. Evil is the destruction of freedom. Thanks for checking out my presentation. Check out endevil.life, freedomundernaturallaw.com. Take spiritual mathematics into your life and do the math. It's all about you.